The following Dharma talk was given by Jodi Hojin Kimmel at the Zen Center of New York City. Hojin Sensei is the abbot of the Zen Center and head priest at Zen Mountain Monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org/zcnyc. Thanks for listening.
Good morning, everyone. I'd like to start with a quote from a Thai forest monk whose books I love to read, Ajahn Chah. This is a simple statement with a lot of depth. Try to be mindful and let things take their natural course. Then your mind will become still in any surroundings, like a clear forest pool. All kinds of wonderful, rare animals will come to drink at the pool, and you will clearly see the nature of things. You will see many strange and wonderful things come and go, but you will be still. This is the happiness of the Buddha. I had another talk going, and I visited a friend this week who is in the last days of her life. And some of us may have that privilege or have had the privilege to be with someone who's dying and very close, to be in their presence. And it really works both ways. What's the most important thing and how we have to do our life alone, even though we are together. We have to do it alone. And as one Qigong teacher said in the beginning of his class, no one gets out of here alive. I was like, oh yeah, that's so true. And I spoke to her. She could hear. She wasn't unconscious. And I told her she had a good long life. She helped a lot of people with her work. She was very kind to me, really good friend, a noble friend, and that she'd been a practitioner all these years, and she was very ripe to completely allow her mind to rest in what was happening, to really take refuge in letting go. Not so easy. Let it all go to nature where it belongs. I asked her if she knew that she was dying, and in her imitable way, she said, I do now. And that was so her. Well, I do now. And I said, okay. And I, you know, and it's mysterious. We don't know, right? That all signs are going that way. And it will happen at some point. But she's close too. And I told her she's going to see all kinds of strange things appearing. And just stay focused. Just stay focused on your breath and be still and just calm yourself. And she had a strong practice. She sat every day on clockwork. She was a clockwork kind of person, very scheduled and disciplined. Just let the mind be still and gather to that knowing that's present in the breath when we can go there. That she's practiced all these many years, that we are doing now, that you just learned, because living and dying are happening constantly, and we're strengthening our knowing, our deeper knowing, our prajna wisdom, before we know with our head what we already know, just being part of nature, and allowing that, allowing ourselves to rest in that, and meeting all these strange and wonderful things at the pond, In the Tibetan Book of the Dead, in guiding someone as they're transitioning in the final moments, it says, "Finally, you'll look upon the breath as if it were a relative that's come to visit you. When a relative leaves, we follow them out. We watch until they've walked down the driveway, until they're out of sight, and then we go back indoors. It's the same way, and we keep awakening the mind. Eventually, the breath disappears, and what remains is the feeling of wakefulness, meeting Buddha, the one who knows, the one who is awake, the radiant one." Ajahn says, "You will clearly see the nature of things. You will see strange and wonderful things, but you will be still." So we can take that advice now. Just as we're encouraged in beginning instruction to not be fooled by the mind, by our thoughts, by visions, by sounds that arise in the mind in zazen, don't take hold of anything. Don't worry about the past and the future. Return to the breath and land in that spaciousness, which is that true knowing. It may just be very brief, that non-dual awareness where you feel that spaciousness, and then we want to fill in again. But the more we practice, the more that spaciousness grows, and we trust it, and we can make more contact with it. Just to be still, we reach that place of no gain, no loss, no retreating or stopping, where there's nothing to grasp, nothing to cling to. We see it clearly for what it is, just a thought arising. We just see it for what it is. We let it pass. But for a while, especially when we're new, we see the clinging, right? The grasping and going into a narrative and off. And then we come back again when we recognize that. That could be a short time. It could be the whole period. It could be a lifetime. And this, my friend, is such a, well, who isn't, but a super controller, right? The one that likes to point, you know. Fighter. She's a fighter. So she's really fighting right now. And we can't do anything about the body except merge with what is. And we practice now to realize that. My teacher used to say in his booming voice, "It's no small thing to be born human." And I always used to be like, "What's he saying? What does he mean? It's no small thing to be born human on so many levels." Our birth and our death are just one thing. I remember I was at a funeral of my friend Tracy. I was very new at monasticism, still very green. And at the funeral, there was a cluster of women, and they were in this hubba bubba, and they said, "Let's ask the monk, she'll know." And I'm like, uh-oh. And they all come descending on me, and they said, "Where's Tracy? Where is she now?" And I was just like, I was trying to settle that myself. And I said, "Well, do you feel her, like, in your heart? Do you feel connected to her? Do you miss her? Are you in touch with her?" And they said, "Oh, yeah." And I said, "There she is. There she is." But I went home with a doubt in me, and I told my teacher, Daito Roshi, what happened. And he said, "Well, how do you understand the self?" He said, "At birth, not a single atom is added, and at death, not a single atom is lost. We had a monastic named Kaijun, and she was so beautiful in her dying days. She couldn't wait. She'd wake up and she'd go, here again. She was just like ready, so ready. It was such a like so different person to person, you know. She was just like, another day. So I told her, I said, Kaijun, today I'm going to a newborn ceremony. There's a new baby. And she goes, I'm so sorry. She said, that's harder. She said, you know, the newborn's just coming in and has to have a whole human life beginning. That was Kaijun. And this is a passage from The Unborn, the Life Teachings of Zen Master Bankei, which I always found very helpful. Bankei was a Japanese Rinzai master in 1622 to 1693. He was very popular. He was the child of a samurai. He encountered death very early, and as a 20-year-old, he went into a hut and just completely devoted himself to zazen. I don't know that we can do that these days, but he just sat, and it's said that his buttocks became raw. That's how deeply he sat, and he didn't take care of himself. He got TB, and he was dying, and he like coughed something up, and it like hit the wall, and apparently that gave him a big insight. That little piece of phlegm kind of broke his mind open, and he saw that he was not born. And so this is his teaching. And so he's explaining his understanding of the unborn. He said, when I teach in these talks of mine, is the unborn Buddha mind of illuminative wisdom, nothing else. Everyone is endowed with this Buddha mind, only they don't know it. My reason for coming and speaking to you like this is to make it known to you. Well then, what does it mean you're endowed with Buddha mind? Each of you now present decided to come here from your home in the desire to hear what I have to say. Now, if a dog barked beyond the temple walls while you're listening to me, you'd know it. You'd know it and hear it, and that it was a dog barking. If a crow called, you'd hear it and know it was a crow. You'd hear an adult's voice as an adult voice and a child's voice as a child's voice. You didn't come here in order to hear a dog bark, a crow call, or any of the other sounds which might come from outside the temple during my talk. Yet while you're here, you'd hear those sounds. Your eyes see and distinguish reds and whites and other colors, and your nose can tell good smells from bad. You've had no way of knowing beforehand of any of the sights, sounds, and smells you might encounter at this meeting. Yet you're able nonetheless to recognize these unforeseen sights and sounds as you encounter them without premeditation. That's because you're seeing and hearing in the unborn. That you do see and hear and smell in this way without giving rise to the thought that you will is proof that this inherent Buddha mind is unborn and possessed of a wonderful illuminative wisdom. The unborn manifests itself in the thought, I want to see or I want to hear, not being born. When a dog howls, even if 10 million people said in chorus, that was the sound of a crow calling, I doubt you'd be convinced. It's highly unlikely that there would be any way they could delude you into believing what they said. That's owing to the marvelous awareness and unbornness of your Buddha mind. The reason I say it's unborn that you see and hear in this way is because the mind doesn't give birth to any thought or inclination to see or hear. Therefore, is unborn. Being unborn is also undying. It's not possible for what is not born to perish. We never came into being, and we never go out of being. All of these comings and goings are just pulses in the pattern. This is the sense in which I say that all people have an unborn Buddha mind. Each and every Buddha and Bodhisattva in the universe, and everyone in this world, of humans as well, has been endowed with it. Being ignorant of the fact that you have a Buddha mind, you live in illusion. Just stop and look back to the origin of this self of yours. When you were born, your parents didn't give you any happy, evil, or bitter thoughts. There was only your Buddha mind. Afterwards, when your intelligence appeared, you saw and heard other people saying and doing bad things, and you learned them and made them yours. By the time you reached adulthood, deep-set habits formed in this way of your own manufacture and emerged. Originally, thoughts have no real substance. So if they're reflected, just let them be reflected. If they arise, just let them arise. If they stop, just let them stop. As long as you're not attaching to these reflected traces, delusions won't be produced. An enlightened awareness is within each one of us right at this moment. This enlightened awareness is truly unborn and marvelously illuminating, and everything is perfectly managed by it. When you walk along naturally, you're walking in the harmony of the unborn. The nature of human beings has changed very little through the centuries. This is 1622, he's saying this, despite numerous efforts to change it. Nor does it seem likely to be less full of passion, jealousy, and hate in the next 1,000 years, here or in outer space. I thought that was very interesting. Like, what's he seeing, right? Conclusively, realize that what is unborn and illuminating is truly awakened and without effort. Rest naturally as the unborn mind. You must have faith that the original mind that is realized and that which realizes original mind are not different. Resting in this way, you are a living Buddha. Yes, this faith in the process, this trust that we're developing in our sitting, in seeing, and what arises in feeling the sensations, the sounds, and just being able to be still and in its presence and seeing it for what it truly is. And this made me think of this poem by Rumi. You know Rumi. He's around 1700 years after the Buddha, 13th century Muslim poet from a Persian family. And he has this poem which somebody sent me this week, and I didn't think twice about it until I started working. I was like, there it is, the guest house. To me, this poem strikes a chord to the depths of our what it's like in our meditative being. And the Buddha also, I found out, used this analogy of the guest house in two sutras in the Pali Canon. They're very short, but I was like, I was surprised to find that. Perhaps the words of the Buddha inspired Rumi, because Buddhist teachings did extend over Asia, deep into Afghanistan. Remember the Buddha statues that were carved into the rocks in Afghanistan, into Iran, which was formerly Persia, and that's where Rumi spent most of his life. And I know I read in the Muslim faith, there's a great deal of emphasis on hospitality in inviting strangers and family and friends, whether they're rich or poor, into your home, being hospitable, showing kindness, to offer one's home as a guest house. So here's what Rumi wrote, and you might hear it in Ajahn Chah as well, and Bankai. This being human is a guest house. Every morning, a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them, even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture. Still, treat each guest honorably. They may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice. Meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. Welcome is a great word, being welcoming. It's part of that compassion aspect of our sitting, to not fight ourselves, fight our thoughts. And we see that it comes with a lot. There's, you know, we go after ourself, we attack ourself and put ourself down, a meanness, a depression, a joy. And he says, welcome and entertain them all, even if it's a crowd of sorrows. It's visiting your guest house. It has come. Treat each guest honorably. It's there. We come by it honestly. You know your life and what's happened. So are we surprised at some of our thoughts and why we do what we do to ourselves? And yet we're changing that. We're transforming that. We're seeing it for what it is. We're resting in reality, in the spaciousness. Doesn't mean it goes away, but we can meet it very differently. The Buddha often commented that the whole world is found in our body and mind. Don't you see that in a period of sitting, all the visitors? They just come while we're sitting. Our family, those we like, those we don't like. Everybody comes to visit, right, in Zazen. And the Buddha takes our responsibility as the host a step further. So in this guest house, which is in the connected discourses of the Buddha said, people go to the guest house from all directions, from all castes and classes. The wise guests have developed the path. They fully understand that which need be understood through direct knowing, to let go of what is, to be let go of, to realize what is to be realized, and develop what is to be developed. That's what a wise guest have developed on the path, and such guests have understood non-clinging, let go of problematic desires, realize liberation, develop calm and insight. So the Buddha and Rumi remind us that guests turn up as different kinds of feelings, as different kinds of experiences, welcome and unwelcome. And the Buddha encouraged us instead to give the guests our fullest attention to see and understand their presence. He put it simply just like that. Just give them your attention and see and understand their presence, simply put. In other words, to be kind, to practice kindness, to see this deluge of emotions as visitors passing through a house and welcome them, no matter how negative they initially appear to be. That every state, every humor is a guide from beyond. And I was remembering something Suzuki said in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, and I found it. And he said, he gave advice on about our relationship with thoughts. Suzuki, who wrote Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, and he said, leave your front door and your back door open. Allow your thoughts to come and go. Don't serve them tea. Now, Milarepa says, he was in his cave, right, meeting his mind. And he said, he was swatting at them, his mind, you know, get out of here, you demon, get out. And of course, demons like a fight. So the more we fight, the more they're like descending on us, right? So you can see that in a period of Zazen. The more you're like, stop it, get out, you know, it's just like, come on, it likes that. So Milarepa said, finally, he said to his demons, come into my living room. Have a seat and I'll serve you tea. So we have two teachers saying something, don't serve any tea, and one saying, serve them tea, give them a seat. And then all of a sudden they're like, this is no fun. You know, this is no fun anymore. And they go, right? But as soon as we're entertaining them and believing them, they're like, yeah, right? In our own mind. I mean, Buddha set an example for this approach to kindness. Because the night before his enlightenment, okay, so he's like well along, you know? And Mara, you may have heard Mara, the demon Mara came to visit. Mara is just an aspect of our mind. There's Buddha mind and there's Mara mind. And Mara mind gets really tight and necessary. And it turns us away from the direction we want to go in that's good, like that part of us, like we know something's good and then we go like, nah, I'm not going to do that. That's Mara mind, right? Or like we want to go somewhere and do something that we know is going to help us and we're like out the door and then we're like, what are you doing? Go home, go to bed, you know, that's Mara. So Buddha was meeting Mara and Mara tempted him with all kinds of stuff, lust, greed, anger, doubt. And for a while, the Buddha just sat there, you know, and Mara kept feeling defeated and then would try something new. And then the Buddha thought Mara left and Mara came back again in his sitting. And finally, Buddha said, I know your name. I know your name. Turn to Mara. I see you, Mara. I know your name, with loving kindness, not fighting, just I see you. I see you, thought. I know your name. And it says, then he would invite him to tea and serve him as an honored guest. So Buddha served them tea as well. Because the Buddha remained undisturbed and at ease, even when he saw finally that really testy one, if you remember, his own reflection. And that was not even true. He just let that be a reflection. And Mara didn't linger. But Buddha said to his dying day, I am always aware of Mara. Pretty interesting. So, after spending time with my friend, I touched her hand. I said, is this okay? And she goes, oh, that feels so good, because my hands were cold, and it felt good on her. So I stayed that way. She liked it. And then I said goodbye. She was falling asleep. And I went into the kitchen, and there's nurse, she's at home, and there's two teams of round-the-clock nurses. So I sat down with one of the nurses, who I didn't know was a Zen master in disguise. Oh my God, this woman was just so beautiful and so kind. And we were talking, and I said, how long have you, I was thanking her for being with my friend at this moment who didn't have any family with her, and for easing her pain. And she just said to me very straight, naturally, in simplicity, what else are we here for? And I went like, I said, you mean being kind to one another? And she said, yes, of course. Otherwise, what's the point of living? She says, but we have to learn to be kind. We have to learn to be kind. She said, this passage is short. Everyone goes. It doesn't matter your skin color, how much money you make, your accolades. We move on alone. I was like, whoa. Thank you. Thank you. And I was thinking about how much talk there is in Buddhism and in columns, cereal boxes, about compassion. And I think it's good. It's good it's out there. We should be talking about compassion. But how many of us really understand it and the vastness of the undertaking of really dedicating ourselves to a life of kindness? It's not an easy path. It's not a short road. And the sure as hell is not predictable. There's nothing predictable about it. The only predictable thing is that if we've lived based in self-delusion and attachments, we'll be unhappy. That's predictable. So we're studying the Lotus Sutra, and in one chapter, Avalokiteshvara, who's the Bodhisattva of compassion, you may have seen her, there's all kinds of statues of Avalokiteshvara, and it's you, as I said, it's identity, you are the one, it's translated as the one who looks down upon the world and hears the cries of the world. That's Avalokiteshvara. So that's each of us. We each look upon this world as a bodhisattva and hear the cries and try and respond, right? And it says, Avalokiteshvara is spoken of as being the one who bestows fearlessness on those who are fearful or those who are in difficult or oppressive situations. How? How can she bestow such fearlessness? How do we do it? How do you do it? By entering your own cave of dragons. By having been consumed with fear, with the demon of fear, and pacifying that anger, that fear, through understanding, through not turning away, not subduing or trying to dominate, but through understanding, they are able to bestow fearlessness to those in difficult situations by having been in difficult situations. So as we're going through our own difficult situation, of course we can see that in another. We're not alone. Everyone has it. So we can move from that place to help. We know it. If you've been down, you can really help someone from that place that you know. When fear falls away, what spontaneously manifests is kindness. We've entered our own craziness, our upside downness. Buddha said we're all topsy-turvy. Even he was. And that's where he turned. What is that? So what prevents us? What suppresses that natural compassion? Fear? Is it fear? Kindness is giving, it's serving, it's raising the Bodhi mind like we did. So let me end with going back to the beginning again for Ajahn Chah's statement. Try to be mindful and let things take their natural course. Then your mind will become still in any surroundings, like a clear forest pool. All kinds of wonderful, rare animals will come to drink at the pool, and you will clearly see the nature of things. You will. You will clearly see. If you stay with your practice, you learned now, you can do it at home. But we need support, obviously. But you will begin to see things as they are. But you're going to have to go through, we all do and still do, our craziness, our upside downness, our topsy-turvy. And that's where we develop that kindness, that not turning away, that fearlessness. The mind will become still in any surroundings. All kinds of wonderful, rare animals will come to drink at the pool, and you will clearly see the nature of all things. You will see many strange and wonderful things come and go, but you will be still. That's where we were guiding her. That's what we were practicing in that moment together, our stillness. This is the happiness of the Buddha. And this is your happiness. This is my happiness. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about the Zen Center of New York City's programs, retreats and residency, please visit our website at zmm.org/zcnyc.